Hello and welcome to the Future of Europe podcast, a production by the European Network. Europe is at a crossroads and there are many predictions as to what direction it will take, and in this podcast we will look at the key issues that will affect the European sphere in the next decade. Our podcast covers the big topics that will affect the future of nations that inhabit the European continent, and we will also bring a uniquely Irish perspective and address how the smaller European states are going to progress by using Ireland as a benchmark. Our guests will be from many different walks of life and backgrounds, each bringing their own ideas on how the Europe of today will become the Europe of tomorrow. This series is presented in cooperation with the Communicating Europe Initiative, and the CEI was established in 1995 to raise awareness about the European Union and to improve the quality and accessibility of public information on European issues. You can find out more about the CEI by visiting their website at dfa.ie. My name is Ken Sweeney, and in this episode we will discuss the future of education in Europe. Helping me today is Paloma Lance. Paloma has studied education policies for global development, and in the past few years she has worked for a number of NGOs, the European Commission, and as a research consultant for UNESCO and UNICEF. But while Paloma is not working, she is one of the producers of The Living Education, which is a podcast that looks at education and learning around Europe and the world. Thank you for joining me today, Paloma. How are you?
Hi, hello. I'm good. It's finally sunny in the Netherlands, so super excited. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, brilliant. I mean, when we thought about putting this podcast together, this episode, we immediately thought of you guys and the Living Education. So I'm just wondering, before we start, could you maybe tell our listeners a little bit about the podcast, The Living Education, what it's about and what your goals were?
Yeah, for sure. So the Living Education podcast is a bit of a crazy idea of three friends who studied together a master's in education policies for global development. And regularly we were discussing big debates about education in Europe, but also globally. And we thought that it would be nice to continue these discussions in a podcast to create a bit of a community. Our idea is to find cool education initiatives around the world and kind of give them a voice, a space, and create a sense of community of people that are passionate, just like us, about education.
That's brilliant. Has it got a global audience, or is there mainly people from Europe listening to it?
A bit of both, actually. Of course, we have the bulk of our listeners are in Europe, but we also have sometimes groups in the US, in Brazil, in Latin America, because we do some episodes in Spanish. I host them in Spanish, so we have a bit of audience there too.
It's fantastic. And what I like about it is that you have a wide range of topics. You cover stuff like from very specific types of education systems to something very broad. And then you go kind of step a little bit outside the loop and you have podcast series episodes where you're just talking to everyday people like me, because I was a guest. I was lucky enough to be a guest on it with my daughter. I wanted to talk to you first about education systems across Europe. I know it's a very broad spectrum, but I thought we maybe start by looking at different types of education systems in the EU. For example, we have Mediterranean versus Scandinavian, and then versus Britain and Ireland. So I wanted to ask you, in your own opinion, what are the best performers and what makes them so?
Thanks for that question. Actually, it's super interesting, and we always tend to compare to one another, while in reality, contexts are so diverse. So as you know, there is this big way of measuring PISA, that is of the OECD, that tries to measure who are the best performers. And a bit like instinctively, the best performers tend to be Scandinavian model and the worst ones Mediterranean. But of course, it really depends what we are looking at. I think it's important when looking at education, not only about how well we can read, write, and do maths. For me, education is a journey, is about socialization. I think now with COVID, we have realized even more how important it is to understand education processes as really a social process and interaction, but also about feeling happy, about learning, to be curious. So performance is hard to say. Of course, there are differences between education systems. So hard to respond. And I think what is important is to look at what makes each of these education systems special and why they work in their own context or not.
Every single education system in Europe has, you know, thinks they're really good. And, you know, even in Ireland here, we would, you know, think we've a very good education system, but we'll probably touch on some of the aspects of that later on in the podcast. But let's maybe look at something then that we can probably put a finger on. And that is, what would be the big developments? And so what do you think are the big developments in European education in the next 5 to 10 years? Because obviously we are talking about the future of education here.
It's important to look at the future and imagine how it will look to be able to prepare young people to this new future. For me, it's really interesting to look this year what the pandemic has really taught us. And I think it has already told us many things about how education is already changing and is looking, and what would be the main pillars of this education system. So digitalization is central. We've seen more and more schools really being forced to transition to digitalization. And with that, of course, the role of private actors, all your kids have used Google Rooms or Zoom, and what are the roles of these big private entities in the education systems. But it's also, we have realized how, although it did work to work from home, we were missing big things. As I said before, for me, the social part is a bit lost during this time. We have all realized how important it is, and we are finding new ways in education to host and to really make this interaction happen really in a meaningful way. And of course, I think the autonomy of the student is a central point. How can we be sure that students become autonomous, independent, how they can learn to critically look at things to be able to learn on their own, but also in groups? So that's a bit the main angles where we can look at the education for the future.
Sometimes early learning and primary can get a little bit of a raw deal, because, you know, when you think about education, adults tend to think about the last type of education system that they were involved in. So third level and secondary tends to get a little bit of an edge. But I think the role of early childhood education and later development is crucial. And it has always been an accepted pillar in European society. But I wanted to know from you, how are individual states introducing their children to the learning process?
That's a super important question for me. And I think we all, big institutions, NGOs, but education systems are trying to really focus on early childhood education. I have lately finished a research on that, actually, and especially on the parenting part of it, because I think early childhood education can only go hand with hand with really the role of parents in education and as primary, as secondary, or kind of accompanying the education process. So, of course, you know that there is a lot of countries that try to start education later so that they have more family time. But of course, there is a lot of research showing the benefits of starting early, of really. And for me, the most important part, I think, is those first years really make a difference in terms of equality. In a family where the parents have time to read, to read stories, to listen to music, to spend time with their children, then of course the integration to the primary education, it's easier. But in families where they have to work for the whole day, they don't have time to really interact, and then the reproduction of inequalities really happens at primary education, where these children that didn't have that opportunities struggle to really integrate into the primary levels.
So what do you think should be done to give future young children a better start?
For me, this is a very personal and question. I was raised in the French education system that is all about assimilation and kind of have this model of what a French person should be, and really mold people into that frame. But then I studied my university in the UK, who has a very different approach to it. And it's, of course, always tricky. I have changed various time education systems as a child, but also as an adult, as a teacher and as a student. And it's always interesting to see to what extent children are able to really integrate or to feel this sense of belonging that is so important in the education process of a child. What is the best way? Of course, to me, is that not only the children have to adapt to the system and but also that the system adapts to children so that they feel that they belong, that they feel that they can express themselves and be themselves and to be accompanied in the way they want to express themselves. And that's the best way. I have an amazing example. I am also Spanish, and we have a Rome community that is super big and has been there for 5 centuries, and we are still not able to integrate them correctly into education. However, some schools have amazing initiatives where they have really started to understand that the only way to integrate, really integrate people, is to represent them, to have their representatives. So there is teachers from the Rome community. They have adapted the timetable so that it adapts to their way of living in some cases. They have literature references from their culture, musical references, etc. And that makes, and also the location of the school, of course, if they have to travel across the cities to reach the education centers, that of course won't help integration. So there are many good examples of good integration and diversity, and I think we should really invest our time and efforts to have diverse schools, because we learn so much about this diversity.
I suppose it's always a ongoing effort, and as long as there is an effort, that's a positive attitude.
And contextualize it. For me, the most important is there is no way that, not method that fits it all. We have to really look at the particularities of each place and each community to be able to give the best solutions. We cannot find one solution for all situations.
I want to touch on a subject now that is kind of close to the heart of many a parent here in Ireland. That is the idea of the Irish education system and its connection with the Catholic Church. Now, I know you're not from Ireland, so I'm going to push this in a broader scale. But as of 2021, the national total of 3,126 standard schools in Ireland had 88% of Catholic patrons, and 5.7 of them were controlled by the Church of Ireland, and then 1% were controlled by other religious organizations. 5.4% is controlled by organizations that are not affiliated with any particular religion. Now, we could have a separate podcast on that, okay? So yeah, there's no point in even going in there. But what I wanted to know is that, is Ireland unique, or is there any similar partnerships in the European Union at the moment like that?
Well, for me, when I hear this case, for me, the first example that pops up is Spain, for sure. Although we have a clear separation between state and church, until very recently, even in public schools, there was Catholic symbolism, there was crucifies, and religion is still taught in public schools. And of course, this means normally Catholic Church, although now it is changing. There has been a lot of changes in the past 5 years. And for me, what is more relevant to talk about is, in Spain, we have something that they are called, that are semi-private systems. So they are supported partially by the state. And this can be fully Catholic. And that raises a lot of questions. And there is a lot of debate in Spain, I think a bit similarly to Ireland, on what is the role for that. In another hand, there is the model of France, who really thinks that education, public education, has to be 100% like, and any sign of religious affiliation is really frowned upon and not allowed. And then there is the model of the UK that also is interesting for me, where it's a bit the opposite. There should be space for everyone to feel represented. And then there is a lot of schools that are not only Christian, but also Muslim, etc. So what is the best option? I don't know. As I said before, I think it really depends on each community and what is the perception of the community. But of course, everyone should find its place in the school community, in the school, in the classroom. And if a religious element doesn't allow that space for each individual, then maybe it's time to rethink it.
People would say that there are benefits to church involvement in the education system. So does religion have a place in education, or is it still, should it be a sense that we should always be mindful of how that works?
I think we have to always be mindful of how they work. Personally, I do not think that religion have a place, but I do understand that in some communities, religion plays such an important role that not having it in the education process doesn't allow everyone to feel comfortable and to really be part of the education process. So we have to be mindful, and sometimes there is, of course, benefits also to having religion, especially when they play an important role in communities. But when all expressions can as well be respected, and there is place for everyone to
indeed
feel,
yeah. So the next question I have, of course, is we're moving along the educational scale here. So let's look at secondary education in Europe. Now, it's massive. Again, as I said, it's another podcast because there are so many different systems, never mind how they're run. But let's just pick one. So I thought we could talk about the German model. Germany is especially well known for its vocational education pathway and the selection process at secondary level. So to what extent do these selection mechanisms contribute to the reproduction of inequalities?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite topics. I was part of a research group in Barcelona that focused on these pathways through or towards tertiary education, focusing on secondary education. And for me, it's really important. I think we all kind of secretly admiring to some extent Germany because they're so good in integrating young people into this kind of very manual work, and they have also this internship, and it's very well known. However, we see that actually these systems that are where the selection mechanisms happen at such a young age, here in the Netherlands, for example, the exam, I think it's when you are around 11 years old, I think really sometimes closes the pathways and really reproduces inequalities. We tend to see that people that come from first or second generation of immigration or from lower economic backgrounds tend to choose these vocational education pathways, not choose, but they are forced into, whereas higher class or from educated families, or where they call here in the Netherlands native or non, not issues from immigration, tend to go to a more academic towards university pathway. And we realize that although in paper one can switch from one pathway to another, in reality it is a lot more complicated, and these bridges are not so well in place or do not allow this mobility as it appears. So it is really important to not only look at this, but also to understand what are the needs of the labor market. How can people really be integrated into society? I don't know if you've seen, there is the new Erasmus Mundus, Erasmus program that was issued this year. There is this focus on vocational training and integration into society and the labor market. But how do we do that to be able that everyone has equal chances and no one is really left behind? I think it's key to really think about these issues when thinking about secondary education.
And we also probably need to have more people talking to each other from different types of secondary education to see what what each can learn from that. So we move on now to third level. Third level is, as we all know, it's a really important time in the life of young adults because it's the changes that they make from here on in are going to have crucial impact on their lives. So how can we promote both quality education at third level across Europe while ensuring that all young people have the opportunities they deserve. Because what we don't want is people obviously going in, taking on something in university and finding that it's not really for them, or maybe they shouldn't even be there at all. So what can we do to make sure that that works okay?
Yeah, for me, it's a bit linked to what we were saying before. It's really looking at and preparing very well the secondary education to be able to really do a selection that meets the need of the people, but also of the market, but also of society, and really prepare young adults to make these decisions that, as you are saying, really have an impact for the rest of their lives. And for me, the crucial point is about a bit that you were touching it upon before, is about communication, is really making education systems that converse and talk and dialogue with the labor market, but also academic sector, to all sectors of society, because it's not only about getting a job, it's also being active citizens, about playing a role in society. And that's really important, I think.
So, yeah, I mean, it is always that communication is the key to both understanding what people want and then finding out what they really need. Because, you know, people can want something and sometimes they don't need it. I want to just slightly go off topic and ask you a question about the third level education. In the Moldovan podcast that we did, the Moldovan Coffee Break, we had one of our guests who spoke about that in Moldova. A lot of people went to university. And then mm-hmm. they found that they didn't really want to go to university because it was either through pressure from their parents or the fact that the university is free. Is this a problem that's endemic across Europe, or is it just something that's maybe in relation to countries where there's free third level education?
Yeah, I think it's a problematic that has always been there in Europe, at least. Of course, now with increasing privatization of tertiary education, I think this is no longer going to be the case, or at least a lot more or less. As you can see, the UK is becoming always more expensive. Here also now students in the Netherlands are becoming more in debt with education costs. So I think it's becoming less and less of a problem, which for me is really concerning, because to me everyone should have the right to go to a university if they want, and this should not be directly related to the labor market. It has a lot to do with aspirations and personal aspirations also, and of course we shouldn't force anyone or feel that it's a needed step in the education process, but we should all have the choice or the opportunity to go if we wish so. And I think a bit what you were saying is I think the solution that the EU has found to this kind of over long, like paying for long careers and people not really invested into the education, is the Bologna plan, where they have really reduced the number of years one student can be at university. And so, yes, I think it's an important debate to have and to adapt to each of the countries where we look at.
And in this part, Erasmus plays a role, I suppose, yeah. Because what it does is it expands people's concept of what university is about. You know, traditionally, it's kind of been seen. I remember when I was very young, which was quite a long time ago, Erasmus was initiated. I think an Irishman actually initiated. But the thing about it was is that at the time, you know, it was seen as elitist. And I think the European Union has worked very hard to get that, you know, image removed from the idea of it. And so it's much more open door policy now. I can see that myself. But I'm wondering, with regards to the future development of Erasmus, I mean, can they take it further? Can we look forward to seeing new elements of that concept?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. I think when we think of students or young people, we cannot, at least in Europe, we cannot look and not take into consideration Erasmus. Now, for so many years, it has been such a crucial program. And yes, we actually just recently did an episode with the Living Education on this, where we talked to two people from the European Commission who explain the new developments of the Erasmus program. And mainly it is about integrating the people, every person in the EU into these programs. Of course, mobility has been a challenge, as Erasmus has always been about mobility, about meeting your neighbor and really knowing what other European young people were doing. This year it's been a bit more complicated, but they have found ways where these connections could be made online or where mobility took other forms. It's important also not to forget that actually Erasmus not only focuses on the mobility of students, but also of teachers, to really enrich the education process. It is still, in my opinion, elitist, because it's you. One has to know where to ask and how. But of course, it's a lot more open and reaching more and more people every day. So I really think it's something to learn from. It's one of the oldest programs we have related to education, I think, in the world. So that is encompassing so many countries and people.
Yeah, and we did an interesting thing here in Ireland, because what we allowed was that people from Northern Ireland can still go on Erasmus, even though they're based technically in the UK. Which brings me to the next question, and it's our final question, but I'm sticking to the Erasmus concept. Can the concept of Erasmus be, you know, developed in the sense that it could step outside of the European Union, or is that already happening? Because you'll have to forgive my ignorance if that is the case. So, for example, can we look at Erasmus Plus for, say, countries like in the Eastern Partnership?
Well, actually, it is happening. And
yeah, I thought
that's
so. I'm sorry about that. It was just my ignorance. Go on, yeah.
No. I think it's because I think many people don't know it. And actually, it's one of the priorities of the new Erasmus program since, I think, almost 10 years. And it's something we don't always think about when we think about the Erasmus program, that it actually also reaches what they call neighborhood countries. So there is a lot in the eastern part, but also in North Africa and some countries in the Middle East. For example, when I was working at the Commission, we were involved in the VET vocational education training, and many countries such as Egypt, Lebanon, Algeria, we're involved. So I think that's the beauty of it, that Europe is actually about bringing together and really creating a unity and an understanding of between each other. There is also an international part of Erasmus that actually makes cooperation, for example, with universities in the African continent. Also in, I think there is a couple of programs that work with Asia and the US, for example. So actually is spreading, I would say.
Which is a positive thing, of course, because, and of course, you know, I've heard somebody once, just to sum up on this, they said before that Erasmus is positive EU propaganda. So I'm not going to subscribe to that, but it's certainly something that would, you know, could be as skewed as that, you know?
I think that's one of the kind of skeptic lens we have to put. And of course, I think it is partly true, but at the same time, it is also giving opportunity to many, including myself, to study abroad and
And I think if positive propaganda means that people have freedom of movement and freedom of education and just being able to work across Europe without any restrictions, well, then that must be a good thing. So there's nothing bad with that at all. Thank you so much for taking the time to have such an amazing conversation with us today. And thank you, of course, for your expertise on what is a difficult and such wide-ranging subject to cover. So I think you've done superbly. Thanks so much, Paloma.
Thank you. And it was very my pleasure to be with you today and to discuss these themes, which I'm really passionate about.
Yeah, you can certainly see that.
So let's continue talking about this among everyone. And I think the discussion should continue to really look at the future of education.
And how we do that, of course, is that we check out your podcast, The Living Education. So you can tell me some details. How can people get to listen to the podcast?
Yeah, that would be great. So we have a website, it's the Living Education com, and we have also our social media. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, and we are also present in all the famous podcast apps, so Spotify, Apple Podcast, and so forth. So yes, please have a look at what we're doing, leave comments, and we will be super happy to start a debate with all of you.
Super, thanks. My name is Ken Sweeney, and you've been listening to the Future of Europe podcast by the European Network. I want to thank my colleague Paloma Lance for joining me today. It's been an amazing conversation. And of course, you can also find us on all the leading podcast platforms, such as Spotify, Apple, Anchor, whatever, you know them at this stage. And also, we will have a website, www.theeuropeannetwork.eu. We'll be coming soon with the next episode in the Future of Europe podcast. So thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll see you real soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
The Future of Europe podcast is a production by the European Network in partnership with the Department of Foreign Affairs in Ireland. Executive production by Ken Sweeney. Writing assistance by Francis Cowell. Sound production assistance by Darren Hendley. Research and development by Paloma Lanz and Claudia Cavaya. You can find our podcast at theeuropeannetwork.eu.